Hello, this is Mike Harrath with another Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. Revenue Rocket is the world's premier growth strategy and M&A advisor for IT services companies. And I'm fortunate enough to be here today with my partners, Ryan Barnett and Matt Lockhart. Hey, guys.
How's it going, Mike?
Today, we're talking about post-closing liabilities and how those are handled, even if you don't know about them in an IT services M&A transaction, how the balance sheet is typically managed, how you get credit for working capital that's not collected at the time of close, it's tied up in AR, for example. So a variety of kind of post-closing items that hopefully you guys will find interesting. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ryan.
Thanks for everyone for listening here today, and thanks for having us on here, Mike and Matt. Today, when you think about the M&A process, the signing a definitive agreement is a really exciting time. You know, your due diligence has been completed. Everyone's agreed to the terms. Checks are getting signed. And your life as part of a new company is about to start. That said, there are times in which not all parts of the business are known. You may have some outstanding portions or liabilities. You may have some undisclosed things that just didn't come up in the process. And there's what we often call just a true-up period. And today we're going to dive into some of these areas that buyers and sellers run into once the check is signed and the companies are starting to integrate. And go from there. So, Matt, I'm just going to start off with the most softball question. You know, what is a true up, and what's that mean for buyers and sellers?
When you close the deal, everything isn't known, right? I mean, if you think about it, there's accounts receivable as a simple example, and that accounts receivable in terms of how that is negotiated regarding, who's going to be taking that cash is an example. And then if an account isn't received, well, then, you know, one party or the other is going to need to provide a true up. It's just making everything come even based upon, you know, the negotiated deal, right? And so, you know, I think that the big point in this is that everybody does their best effort, right, to, be as clean as possible towards defining everything in the definitive agreement. But sometimes there are things that are simply unknown at the time of closing. And so you need to have your arrangements in place in terms of how things will be trued up in a relatively short period after closing.
Okay, that helps. So it's something, almost think of it as maybe an expense has accrued but not paid out. I could see maybe an employee bonus might fit into something that might take away from a seller, or on the flip side, something that came in or unexpectedly AR that wasn't accounted for in a working capital true up might hit either side favorably or unfavorably. But there is a bit of a grace period in which, kind of the big number has been solved, but there's some small numbers that need to be cleared out. Mike, if you could help me understand, there's this also a concept of representations and warranties. They're more often called reps and warrants. This helps protect sellers from kind of meaningful disclosures and so, or protects buyers, pardon me, from kind of meaningful changes in the business. Mike, how does that is? Can you help explain that? And is that different? And how does that work up in a true up? Or are those completely different concepts?
No, I mean, they're interrelated, right? So representations and warranties are when a seller represents that the business condition is a certain way or warrants that it's in a certain way or that things are known. So, for example, they would represent that everything that's on the balance sheet, the closing balance sheet, is a liability that is known. Now, as a practical matter, sometimes things get, you know, overlooked. And what I mean by that is they may think they're known, and they may in fact actually be known, but something as simple as like a utility bill that covers part of the time when a seller owned the business and part of the time when a buyer owned the business, the portion of that liability that at that time was unknown because they hadn't received the bill, right, and would be the part that was, you know, the utility for, say, your rent space or maybe an internet access bill or something, would be the responsibility of the seller, okay? And so their reps and warrants are still intact because they didn't know about the liability, but there is a liability nonetheless. And the short answer is that liabilities in a true up or assets in a true up have to do with, you know, if you own the business, say, until the 1st of July, anything that occurred before the 1st of July is your responsibility. Everything that happened, you know, as it relates to a liability or an asset that comes into the business after the 1st of July is the responsibility of the new owner. But where reps and warrants become important as it relates to a true-up is in the event that there is not full disclosure. So as we've talked about reps and warrants in the past, reps and warrants have to be accurate. If they're not accurate at the time of closing, based on what you're disclosing or attesting to, then you're putting, you know, you're risking that you're going to have legal issues with your buyer after close. So it's important that, you know, those are clearly covered with your lawyer and that you understand and that you've made full disclosures. And if there's liabilities in particular that you know about as a seller, that they have been fully disclosed to the buyer so that they can either be managed through the true-up process or it can adjust the purchase price and it can be resolved at closing.
So if I understand this right, the reps and warrants, let me ask this differently. What is a penalty of a breaching a rep and warrant? So if the doc, if you've already been done and you're, let's say, in this true up process and a rep and warrant does happen, what's the repercussions of that?
Well, there's some indemnity cap and basket and some withholdings that can be had by buyer typically to cover their exposure on this item. And it may mean, you know, it's not uncommon to escrow a portion of the purchase price, sometimes as much as 10%, to cover reps and warranties, right? So if there's a violation of a rep and warranty that would impact the buyer negatively, they can reach into that escrow and take that money to cover that liability. Now, there's other ways to cover reps and warranties, like, you know, it's becoming pretty popular recently to have representation and warranty insurance policies. And there's insurance companies that write coverage after evaluating the risk of a rep and warrant violation. And you can, for a much lower number than 10% of the purchase price, ensure that there will not be any reps and warranty violations, because it's very unlikely, just as a practical matter, unless there's a bad actor, that there's going to be a rep and warrant violation on its face, because you've got all kinds of lawyers that are looking at it and asking their respective clients, you know, are these representation and warrants accurate, right? Because it exposes a seller if they're not accurate. Let's say you intentionally left a liability off the balance sheet, or you knew of a contingent liability that you didn't disclose, it's ultimately going to get discovered, likely, and you'll have to pay it either out of your escrow for reps and warrants, or as part of a true up, or as part of a earn out reduction, or from the reps and warrants policy. So there's a variety of remedies that a buyer has in that situation. But it also, depending on the size of that violation, if you will, or non-disclosed liability, it could even, you know, warrant a raise to the level of litigation if there's not enough coverage built into the way the purchase agreement or the escrow or the insurance was built.
Okay. Okay. And if I, again, in the purpose of understanding here, it sounds like a reps and warrants violation would be a fairly serious clause. Do you have an example of where that might be? Something that would...
Well, yeah, I mean, someone may, for example, they may know that they have a risk of a tax liability. Let's say they knew about it, that, oh, I didn't pay sales tax or something in a previous year for a particular transaction that might be warranted, or maybe there's a franchise tax. That was another deal we're working on in a certain state. You know, Massachusetts has a franchise tax for businesses under $9 million. You know, maybe the seller wasn't compliant with that, or there was some issue that they knew about, that the seller knew about, but didn't disclose the liability, either because they were trying to skirt the tax, or they were just going to take a risk that they were going to get audited or whatever. And then it comes to light that that was intentionally left out of the disclosures. Well, you know, they're going to be responsible. The seller's going to be responsible for that post-close. Not only that, it creates obviously a bad taste in the mouth of the buyer if you're not fully forthright in your disclosures. Your disclosures, in short, have to be absolutely accurate. And, you know, you have to, most lawyers go to painstaking efforts in advising you, if you're a seller, to make sure that every statement you're making in those disclosures at the time of close is 100% accurate. If you do that, then you're not going to have these risks. Now, you may have liabilities that come up post-close, which is really the topic of this podcast, that would impact the true-up. Those are different, right? Those are not things that you didn't disclose that you knew about. These are things that come up kind of post-close that you didn't know about. And that's much easier to manage in a true-up. A true-up oftentimes is built because there's a portion of the working capital reconciliation that has to get paid after the new buyer collects the money in AR. That's the primary reason for that true-up. However, there are unknown liabilities, not undisclosed, but unknown liabilities that could come up. Like, you might have somebody send you a bill that wasn't in the books for whatever reason. Maybe it got missed somewhere. Or maybe, there's this utility bill and, you know, internet access type, you know, connectivity billing. Oftentimes utility bills are, or there's CAM charges in your rent bill, you know, rent that you hadn't fully amortized appropriately. I mean, there's a variety of things that can come up that just get missed or you just didn't know about. And those will also impact that true-up. You won't collect probably as much as you thought in that situation if you have unknown or liability challenges that come up later. You'll have to cover those. Just like it would happen, there would be assets that you would get. So, for example, what happens is if you cancel your professional liability insurance, or any insurance for that matter, could be in your office, you're going to cancel some sort of insurance, you're going to get a credit effective on the closing date for any prepaid amount of that insurance. Well, that's your money, right? You've already paid it. You probably haven't accounted for it, maybe as something that you've prepaid on your balance sheet. Sometimes those things get missed. And so when it comes up, you go, oh, yeah, I forgot that I had my, you know, I'm canceling my liability insurance before the premium that I've paid through the end of the year. So I get a credit. And when that check comes, typically it'll get deposited in the business, but it'll be owed to you at the true up. So hopefully that adds some clarity to the question.
It certainly does. I think one of the few things that kind of makes me just wonder about are what is there a typical length for a true up? Like, is it 30, 90, 60 days or 30, 60, 90 days? Is it years? Is it forever?
No, it's usually 90 days. That's pretty standard in market. Because it also aligns to an collection period before AR is considered uncollectible. So you should know that if you have AR that's on your balance sheet at close and it's owed to you because it's part of a working capital reconciliation, that, you know, you actually, most buyers will say, well, yeah, we're happy to, you know, pay it to you, but you got to collect it. You got to collect it first, right? Because what those buyers are worried about is when there's change of control, maybe a client will stop paying or they'll issue the check incorrectly, or, you know, there could be something that would impair the ability of that buyer to collect the money. And as such, they're not going to pay it to you, right? Or if for whatever reason, maybe there's a change in business conditions of one of your clients and they choose to not pay an invoice. And so you're not going to collect that, right? So it's not, it's typical that you have a 90-day kind of window for a true-up. It gives an opportunity to collect the AR kind of post-transaction that would be hanging out there that could be owed to you as part of a working capital reconciliation. And it's in everyone's interest to do so.
And then are there, again, digging in a little bit more, if does this apply to any kind of earn-out possibility? And maybe this question is needs some help with the question, but say if you lose a customer after close and they've decided after the acquisition that they no longer want to be a customer, is that something that's would that be a rep and warrant issue? Is that a true up issue? Is that just the luck of the draw? Kind of what happens in some of those early, you know, customer transition problems? And Peel, does it matter? Mike, Peel, either one can answer this.
Yeah, what I would say is that it depends, not to be vague with my answer, but, you know, if it's not known and you've warranted that it's not known, and it comes up post-close, let's say, we were kind of thinking of changing anyway, and because you sold the business, we're gonna change. It is kind of a luck of the draw situation, the risks that buyers take. Now, it could impact you as a seller if you built an earnout based on that, assuming that client would stay, right? Just like your earnout should accommodate any new customers that get added, right? You should get credit for those post-close. That's part of the deal. You're taking risk in those future periods, and, you know, there's risk and reward, and you got a risk that, you know, clients could roll off, and you got to, you know, get the reward if you get new, net new clients. So now everything changes if you didn't disclose it, right? If you got notice a week before close and you didn't disclose that client was rolling off and it's discovered afterwards, not only would it impact your earnout, if, I mean, you have an earnout, but it would be a rep and warranty violation, and then your buyer would have the ability to reach into an escrow or leverage an insurance policy, or, you know, maybe apply it or withhold the true up. A lot of that depends on how the document is written, the definitive agreement. So it just comes back and reemphasizes that, you know, you want to be really clear and earnest about your reps and warrants, so that they don't impact your true up or don't impact your earn out or don't impact an escrow that might be being held to cover those reps and warrants.
Yeah, makes sense. And thanks for all the clarifications here. It's a really interesting topic. Matt, I wonder what advice do you have to buyers or sellers on just minimizing the risks that are associated with any of these liabilities?
Well,
Be very clear, but also very detailed about what you're disclosing. That it's absolutely not worth, you know, trying to obfuscate or, you know, keep something under a veil, right? I think that it also speaks to the goal to align a cultural fit, in a way, that if you demonstrate openness right out of the gate, say, for example, you've got a challenging customer, right? And here's how you're managing that customer, but just so you know, it's a challenging customer. Well, everybody has challenging customers, right? Everybody has projects that are at a certain amount of risk, right? And the more open that you can be about the state of the business, right? Assuming that you've got a well-run business, the easier it is going to be to negotiate all of these items, because you're negotiating from a position of credibility and truthfulness, and so from a seller's perspective, that makes a whole bunch of sense. From a buyer's perspective, I think that Mike, we maybe didn't even touch enough on it, is that absolutely important to protect yourself and to protect from could be bad actors or unknown things. If you want to get a deal done and you're trying to overprotect yourself, right? You're just super risk mitigating. Well, you're at risk of not getting the deal done, of not getting the value that you're looking for. I mean, we've had buyers that have tried to put 25-30% in reps and warranties, and it's like, well, no, you're never going to get a deal done there, right? And so I think that's another just sort of piece of advice around the deal making and actually getting something done.
Yeah, as I often say, win-lose deals don't get done, right? It's got to be win-win. You have to kind of walk a mile in the shoes of the other person on the other side, think through how you would handle it if you were on the other side of the table. If you approach the negotiations that way as it relates to, any of these topics in M&A, I think it'll help get the deal done. If it's one-sided, it's very unlikely. I don't know, never say never, but very, very unlikely that the deal will get done because there's just too much scrutiny from advisors with experience like Revenue Rocket or lawyers on both sides or accountants. They're going to be crying foul here and saying, hey, this isn't going to work. I wouldn't recommend this because of the following reason. So, I think if you're down the middle of the plate on a lot of these topics, you're reasonable. You're sort of keeping in mind what is really win-win, then, you'll find a good place to land and ultimately, be in a position to, have folks be happy, about the transaction years out from it.
Yeah, to echo both your points, we want to look for those win-win transactions that have the true intent of why the M&A process happened and the successful acquisition was done. Sometimes you do have these bumps in the roads, just understanding what's out there, and that true period helps companies successfully navigate what those unknowns may come through for a limited amount of time. And buyers also have the protection of the reps and warranties. As a matter of practice, I don't think we've ever seen a reps and warranties cap and basket ever be impacted. Mike, am I right in that? We just have not seen violations of rep and warranty clauses?
No, we haven't seen it in all of our time, 21 years. And in general, I think it's very, very rare. But if you ask any lawyer, they see challenges around reps and warrants. Do they come up post-transaction? I think any M&A lawyer would tell you that in their entire career, they may have seen none to one or two, and that would be in a 30-plus-year career. So it doesn't really happen all that often. And I think that's just because, you know, the legal profession does a pretty good job at advising their clients on, you know, making sure all the disclosures fully disclose what they know. Certainly where we've said before, the true up comes into play is when you, you know, there are things that you don't know that impact, you know, what would be the value of the business per se, like, you know, collecting AR or, you know, liabilities you didn't know about or, you know, whatever it might be, whether it be an asset or a liability. That's why a true up is structured the way it is so you can fairly deal with those issues as the business is fully being transitioned. And, you know, that takes about 90 days.
Okay, makes sense. Matt, Mike, any parting comments?
Work with a good advisor to smooth the path and help you negotiate. I say that a little bit tongue in cheek, but it is absolutely the case. There, you know, some of these things can be complicated, and you have to have somebody on your side, right? So that's it for me. Great topic, though. I mean, complicated stuff, and you know, super interesting.
Yeah, I would echo Matt's comment that, you know, certainly this is an area and a perfect example of where, you know, a skilled advisor in your industry can add a lot of value. These are not very easy to navigate things. And, you know, there's both a business component to them and a legal component. And that's why an M&A advisor can kind of handle off the business aspects of that negotiation. And the legal, your lawyer can help you with making sure it's legally fortified and in a position to, you know, stand the test of time post-close.
Awesome. With that, Mike, take us out.
Sounds good. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in this week. With that, we'll tie a ribbon on it. Take care and make it a great week.